Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Denise Graves has long been known to opera fans. Her voice touched many more people around the country and around the world when she was invited to perform at the National Memorial Service following the September 11th attacks. She's currently here in her hometown, taking on a complex and fascinating role in the Washington Opera's production of Il Trovatore. Denise Graves is here in the studio and will be taking your calls throughout the hour, taking a lovely break from politics with you and your beautiful voice and your beautiful presence. Welcome.
Thank you, Diane. Thank
it's
you.
Good to have you here.
Happy to be here.
I know that in the last few years, you really have faced some fantastic challenges. Go back in time with us and talk about when these challenges, how these challenges began to present themselves.
I think that it began in the year 2000. I was singing in Chicago Lyric Opera for a new production that was being mounted for me of Carmen. And at that time, I noticed what originally started happening is I started getting really, really severe headaches. And they had been diagnosed years ago, back in 1988, when I was doing my apprenticeship with Houston Grand Opera. That was the onset of them. And at the time, the doctors put me on Roboxin, which is a muscle relaxant. And they couldn't find, because headaches are so mysterious, you know, they didn't know what was the cause, and everybody thought stress or, you know. And so anyway, that had been since 1988 that I hadn't had any more of the headaches until the year 2000 when they came back ferociously. And I started taking, I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say this, but I
sure
started taking over-the-counter medication for Advil. And I didn't realize, you already know what I'm going to say.
I had something of the same problem with Advil, but go ahead.
It inhibits clotting, and I had no idea. I'm aware of some of the things that, so many of the things that the singers have to watch out for
of
in terms
course.
Of preserving your vocal health. But I was but that was the one thing that sort of brought a temporary relief of what had been diagnosed as cluster headaches, and that was when you get a series of headaches that congregate in one spot of the brain. We found out that my condition was called occipital neuralgia, and it had to do with the ninth nerve, and it was in a spasm, and it would not stop, and the headaches would come about five or six times a day, ferocious, ferocious. I mean, just to knock you out, I would black out, I couldn't function. I mean, it was really, really terrible. But Advil took care of that for the temporary time, I think there's a window of 3 or 4 hours. And after that, I would take another two. And I was at the limit that you're supposed to, 6 or 8 a day, I'm not sure. Anyway, that's what I noticed that started happening. And then there was a problem with the voice. Because later on, I was able to get through that production of the Carmen, but very, very, very difficult. And from there, I was doing an engagement in Delaware, and the first half went okay, but still it was, I wasn't in form, as we say, you know, the voice wasn't not speaking.
What was happening to the voice?
Well, just the voice didn't have its power, it didn't have its presence, I didn't feel secure at all. I could tell, you know, classical music and studying to be an opera singer is a refined art form. And so what may not be perceived in the public, we're able to detect right away the slightest nuance.
Absolutely.
You know, you can tell if you had too much salt. You can tell if it's dry. You can tell if you had dairy products before. You could tell if you had spicy foods because it is a discipline with such finesse. I think that we're very much in tuned with the instrument itself. And so I was able to tell, you know, it was just, the voice was a bit strident. And I didn't have the power. I was supporting, I was breathing, I was doing all the things that I was taught, you know, to do, but the voice just wasn't responding. Anyway, during the intermission, I sneezed and I completely lost my voice. And I mean, Diane, there was nothing that could come out. There was no sound. And that was the start of the first hemorrhage. And after that, there were a series of 3 or 4 hemorrhages before finally something had to be done. I mean,
How did you know that there was a hemorrhage?
Well, I didn't know actually at the time that that's what had happened.
Yes.
I thought, my gosh, what just happened?
Yeah.
And even my speaking voice became very breathy. And the thing between the difference between opera singers and, you know, probably some of the popular singers is that we sing with compressed air on the two vocal cords, and the popular singers sing with air passing through the vocal cords, and that's why you get that sort of breathy sound. But I got that breathy sound in my speaking voice, and I have a quite resonant speaking voice, and I don't speak nearly as well as I sing, that's for sure. I'm being told all the time that, you know, when you hear opera singers speaking very high, oh, hello, Diane, how are you? There's a reason for that madness, actually. And it's to take the pressure actually off of the vocal cords and to place it into what we call the mask and to place it in more of the resonating cavities like the cheekbones and the full
exactly.
Yes. So my speak immediately, and the voice became very, very raspy and very husky. And I thought, what just happened? So the first half was okay. I knew that I wasn't exactly in form, but there was a dramatic difference. And then the next day, I went to my doctor, Dr. Libin, in New York. And he said, oh, my gosh, Denise, we've got a big problem. And so I know that this happens often to singers because it's a question of maintenance. There's no sports person. I mean, singing, we're athletes, you know. You can hear all the time about some of our great sports people that they're having, you know, I don't know, hamstring pulled or whatever. And that's happening when you're a high-risk performer, as I am. You're going from engagement to engagement to engagement. One has to be very, very careful. So when you hear about the opera singers and all of their different neuroses, so perhaps be a little patient and
exactly.
Understand that there's a reason for that and
hardly
the reason why.
Neurosis. I have to tell you that my vocal problems, which are spasmodic dysphonia, where the basal ganglia of the brain sends an incorrect message to the vocal cords, telling them to go into spasm incorrectly, corrected only temporarily by injections of botulinum toxin into the vocal cords, began with Advil.
Is that right?
I started with a
yes,
a cough, a slight cough. And one day, Senator Barbara Mikulski came onto the show, and I couldn't interview her because the cough was nonstop. And I told her I was taking Advil. And she said, you know, that's one of the reasons we had this huge debate about making Advil an over-the-counter drug because it causes asthma-like symptoms.
Aye.
So, you know, what else may have gotten into your vocal cords as a result? It's always a fascinating question, whether it's a combination of stress, whether, you know, all of that goes into it. But I'm so glad you're back in good voice.
As am I. You know, there's a wonderful doctor by the name of Dr. Steven Zeitels in Boston, Massachusetts, who is doing extraordinary work in terms of stem cell research and vocal rejuvenation, where they're working exactly with those sort of problems.
Interesting.
With spasmodic dysphonia, with the auctioneers who lose their voice, that sort of thing, with
of
singers,
course.
With rock singers. So they're making great, 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 great progress, and I think we'll see.
So they removed a polyp from your vocal cord?
I'm sure he would be able to articulate better exactly, you know, what the technical terms were, but what it was that I was, there was a polyp as well as the hemorrhaging. And what happened, what the reason the polyp, the reason I got the polyp is because after the first bleed, the doctor put me on cortisone. And it sort of is a Band-Aid for a while, and I was able to keep some of my engagements. But boy, was that difficult. That was really, really difficult. I had one engagement in Florida where the doctors there, God bless them, came to my performances and sat in my dressing room every single solitary night to make sure that I was doing the right things. But it was very, 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 very scary. But some of the engagements were too close, and I couldn't cancel them. And I feel a great sense of obligation to honor those contracts. I'm very grateful to do what it is I do. And I know that you and I share another thing in common, because Clay Blackmore I just was part of this DC project for the coffee table book of women and their fantasies.
Yes.
And they asked me, they said, "Well, what is your fantasy?" And I said, "I'm living my fantasy. I really don't have one."
Wonderful.
And I said, outside of winning the lottery, you know, that which I feel that I already have with my daughter and being able to do what I do. And so that's the fantasy that I chose. But I saw your fantasy as well, which I thought was gorgeous, and you look beautiful.
Mine was to be an Academy Award winning actress. So they got me an Oscar to be photographed with. It was such fun. Denise Graves, mezzo-soprano, currently appearing in the Washington Opera's production of Il Trovatore. And when we come back, we'll open the phones, 1-800-433-8850, and take your email. Stay with us. Welcome back. Denise Graves is with me. And as you've been hearing during the first portion of our program, she had serious voice problems that finally, thank goodness, have been corrected. Now, you're here in Washington appearing in a production of Il Trovatore. Tell us about that opera and the role you play.
Well, it's a real departure for me from some of the roles that I guess I've been identified with, some of these sort of, you know, villains. You know, but I'm very, very defensive when we speak of Carmen, when we speak of Delilah, when we speak of those women, because I'm on their side. I mean, I have to be. I wear their skin. And so I'm very, very guarded as to how we speak of them. But some of those sort of sultry, sexy roles, this is a woman who is a much older woman with an older son, and who suffered a great, great tragedy in her life and has since not been able to move forward since that terrible day of watching her mother, who this is the character of Azucena in Il Trovatore that I'm speaking about, who is a gypsy in the, I still can't get away from being a gypsy though, apparently. But anyway, who's a gypsy in the opera and whose mother was also a gypsy, was caught peering into the crib of the baby of the count, And then afterwards, this baby disappeared, and they took her mother because they thought that perhaps she put a curse on this child, and they burned her at the stake. And she witnessed this. Mm. And her mother's last words were, "Avenge me." And she has been frozen in time since that time and sort of turned into, you know, kooky grandma who's always talking about this story over and over and over again. And that's my character. And that is her, that is what she wants throughout the whole of the opera, is to avenge her mother.
I want to hear a little bit of Carmen, because it's such an important role for you. It's the role that people identify with you. Tell us about your feelings about this role.
I've evolved a lot because she and I have been walking hand in hand for a few years now. But I love her as a woman, as a character. I love her strength. I love her resolve. I think she's completely in her body, and she's a very, very strong woman.
Quand je vous aimerai, ma foi, je ne sais pas, peut-être jamais, peut-être demain, mais pas aujourd'hui. C'est certain.
Tell me what you're thinking as you're listening.
It's very noisy inside of my head. I think, oh, I shouldn't have breathed there, and oh, I should have connected this phrase, and oh, I hear my breath too loudly there, and here, I would have made a very different choices today, but I'm a very different person and a very different artist from what I was, when that was recorded about, 8 years ago or something like that. So, I think that artists and people are always very, very critical of their own work. But at the same time, I think I did some lovely things and made some very nice choices. And I thought I don't listen to myself sing that often, hardly ever, even to recordings. There have been some recordings that I haven't even heard, because I just believe in the. I try to be as organic as possible. I try to just go out, and recording is difficult because we're taught to examine everything measure by measure of what we're doing. And I don't think that art should be graded. I mean, it's important to study your work, and that's for sure, but it's not so easy. It's not so easy to hear, but I did some lovely things as well, and so I'm proud of it. I'm proud to have it.
Do you like your voice better today, or do you look back on it and like it better then?
Oh, that's interesting. I like my voice very much. Leontine Price used to say, you have to love the sound of your voice. And I do. There's one bit in the last act of Il Trovatore, just before my other son, not the one that I threw into the fire to kill the character, Azucena, but when he's about to be executed, In the last scene, when the men's chorus comes back in the Miserere, and I say, oh my God, where is my son? And it's so beautifully written in the score, and I love singing that part, and I like the way my voice sounds on that part. Mm-hmm. I always think, okay, yay, here comes that part that I like.
Denise, how long were you out of opera? And what went on during that period?
Oh, my gosh. A lot of dodging. I was out for about a year. And I had to make up a lot of excuses because I didn't even tell my management what was going on. Because in this world of ours, this very fragile world, the classical music business, particularly with opera singers, there's a real stigma attached to having vocal trouble. And I was very, very probably for the same in
it. Exactly. Yeah.
And so I didn't speak about it to anyone at all. I mean, my close friends knew, but not many, maybe two, and my doctor knew. And that was about it. But I had to keep my management was saying, well, why? Why is it that you have to cancel this? I said, oh, I'm not feeling well, or I have this health problem, or whatever. And finally,
the rumors begin
like crazy, you know. And this particular doctor that I saw that took care of me, the one that I mentioned earlier, Dr. Steven Zeitels, you know, running in his office is like backstage at the Metropolitan Opera. I mean, you can't believe all the different your colleagues that you run into in these places. But he's a magnificent doctor, and he really put me back together again. But when you see a colleague of yours, you know, in a place like that, you assume and they assume that, uh-oh, something's going
on. Somebody
knows. Yeah, somebody knows what's happening.
So this went on for a year. What were you going through internally? How was your life changing?
Every part of my life was changing. At that time, I was spending a lot of time on the computer because I couldn't, that was my voice. And so I was sending instant messages to a friend of mine in California, and we got into a very, very long conversation about life. And I started telling her bits and pieces about my life, and she said, you know, Denise, this is a book. This is, you've got to write this down. And so from that period of silence, I really feel like I found my voice because many, many things happened to me in this period, Diane. First of all, before losing my voice, I lost my computer. And then after that, I lost my cell phone. And then I lost my voice. And my palm pilot died. And I said, okay. I looked up into the skies and I said, okay, heaven, so I get this. All communication's off, so I'm supposed to be quiet. What is it that I'm supposed to hear? What am I supposed to learn? Help guide me and open my eyes and open my heart and my mind so that I see what this period is about, because it's very clear to me that communication is out and that maybe I'm supposed to listen. Maybe I'm just supposed to hear in this period. So I tried to honor that. I tried to respect that and just be very, very quiet and just know, you know, and you know what I discovered? That... there's a lot of superfluous talking going on. It's really true. I really realized, you know, I wasn't frustrated at all. I remember a friend of mine telling me a joke that a woman had a baby, and after a year, the baby didn't speak, and after 2 years, the baby didn't speak, and after 7 years, the baby didn't speak. Finally, on the 10th birthday, the baby said, the young person said, would you pass the salt? And he said, oh, my God, you spoke, you know, and said, well, I didn't really have anything to say until now. And so that's what it felt like to me. You know, I thought, gee, I had to hear endlessly, you know, with people and friends around me and my beautiful partner in life, David Perry, I'd had to hear endless conversations about, his conversations about cars and computers and that sort of thing that I had to endure. But I thought, well, I didn't miss it so much. I had to be quiet and I really listened to what people were saying. And I thought, I don't have to interject anything here. It's really not needed.
It's wonderful to sit passively and listen. Actually, not passively, because you are
actively engaged. Absolutely, absolutely. But as I was saying, during this time, I was sending instant messages to a friend of mine. She said, Denise, this is a book. And so I was writing to her these very, very long emails, chapters of my life. And she eventually sold this story to Warner Books. And that's what also came out of this period of silence. And so during this period of change where everything was changing in my life, everything was happening with me personally, with my marriage, also with my management, I changed management, just every aspect of it began to change.
That's a lot of stress.
It's a lot of stress. You know, I was reading the other day in the magazine, they said that the three top stresses that having a child, moving, and separation or divorce is, and for the last, this last year, nearly all three were happening for me simultaneously. So it has been a great, great stress. But at the same time, I've had music in my life. And even whether I'm actively involved in that or not, whether the music is coming from my body or not, I'm still very much engaged as a musician, as a listener, and as a music lover.
You know, as a music lover. At 23 minutes before the hour, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And we'll open the phones now. 1-800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Let's go first to Springfield, Virginia. Good morning, Joanne.
Good morning. I'm so delighted to be on the air with both of you.
Thank you. I was at
Tuesday evening's performance, and it was spectacular. I wanted to say, as Duke Ellington says, it sounds good, it is good. And the reviews in the Washington Post were pretty horrid. So I was wondering if the reviews in any way impact you, affect you? Do they make you want to do it even better or what? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Joanne. Yeah, that's a good question. I really go by my own judgment, and I know if I give a strong or if a good performance, then if I feel satisfied with that, and also by the reaction of the public. And so I've never paid very much attention to the reviews. I don't think that we can afford to invest in that emotionally. Because I remember once being at a concert at the Met and hearing a discussion of two women were having. One was talking about Plácido Domingo and the other was talking about Luciano Pavarotti. And he nearly broke out in a fist fight, you know. And so people have their own tastes and their own... And also sometimes with... operas like this, Verdi's Il Trovatore, where there have been so many wonderful singers in the roles before, we may have a different sound in our ear that we're used to hearing Giulietta Simeonato, who was famous for singing one of the, a real famous Azucena. And so I just let the public, I go by what the public says. But that was very difficult because I did read that review because everybody called and told me about it. And it was difficult for me going into the theater the next performance because there was so much tension.
But we should say that the critic said that your performance was outstanding. He was critical of the entire production, but singled you out. Let's take a caller in Silver Spring, Maryland. Let's go to Debbie. You're on the air.
Good morning, Ms. Graves. Good morning, Ms. Reams. Mm. I wanted to find out if you, by chance, Ms. Graves, have any thoughts of doing a book on your life. I know you're not an old woman, but you've got...
Hardly.
I think we are actually about the same age, but you've had such an interesting life with your breadth of experiences. So I wanted to ask you that question, and also I wanted to find out if how you could recommend, well, what you could recommend to someone like myself. I don't know a lot about opera, but I am definitely going to bite it off and come and see you. I know it's a big expense with the tickets, but I really want to come, but I want to get a little bit of knowledge before I get there and understand about opera. So what can you recommend to someone like me?
Thank you, Debbie. Thank you for your call. When you said Debbie from Silver Spring, I have a sister, Debbie, from Silver Spring. I thought, that's my sister. I know that's her. there were many questions there that I wanted to address. First of all, you'll see what an old woman I am if you come tomorrow night to our production of Il Trovatore is Azucena.
People
quite
have
an old
said
woman.
Your hair looks like Toni Morrison's.
It's true. And, you know, it's true that when you get to the theater and you get into your costumes and you get into your wigs and your makeup, you do feel, I feel very differently, and you walk differently, and you behave differently, and you sort of take, it helps to encourage you and to keep you in character, you know. So I feel very different when I look at myself. I think, my gosh, is that me? You know, sometimes when my nieces and nephews would come to the performances to see me, you know, and I walk in the room, they start crying. They think, who is this woman? You know, what happened to Aunt Denise? You know, so, but I feel very different. I'm often taken back. But to answer your question, Debbie, about what to do, the first thing to do is to just get out there and do it. And if you plan early enough, and you can, I'm sure that the lovely people at the Washington National Opera will be more than willing to help you in terms of choosing, you know, which opera is best to go to for the first time. But if you get in there early enough, you can get very, very reasonable tickets. So that's the first thing. And the other thing is to just go ahead and do it. But I think it would be important to, if you could, read a little bit about it. Now, fortunately, they have the surtitles at the Washington Opera, and that explains nearly word for word what's going on. And that's made a huge difference in the business.
I think so. I think people can enjoy opera more when they understand it. On the other hand, old hands would say what you see on the stage really transforms itself emotionally. We'll take just a short break. When we come back, more of your calls for Denise Graves. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, informing health reform with policy research, data, and expert commentary, on the web at healthreform.org. By Jeffrey Kenner, in appreciation of NPR's international coverage and its foreign correspondents. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
On a summer day in 1974, New Yorkers looked up to see an acrobat walking on a wire between the tops of the Twin Towers. A new novel imagines what was going on in the lives of the people on the streets below. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. Denise Graves is with me. She's appearing here in Washington at the Washington National Opera's production of Il Trovatore. And if you'd like to join us, 1-800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. In addition to nurturing your voice, you are now nurturing a young baby girl. She is so beautiful.
Oh, thank you.
Tell me about your decision to have a child, mm-hmm. why that meant so much to you, mm-hmm. and how it has affected your life.
Oh, my gosh. I've always wanted children, ever since I can remember, but was it unable to have them because of many different things, but mostly fibroid tumors. And I had many different myomectomies to go in and take them out, and then they grow back for some reason. But there was a real problem, and also I only had one tube that was open, and there were many, many complications. And so after a certain amount of time, I was married for 15 years, after a certain amount of time, my doctors just sort of said, listen, Denise, maybe you should consider different options, maybe to find a surrogate mother, you know, because they did a test and they thought that the eggs were okay. And even adoption. Anyway, one of my gynecologists here in Washington even called me about the possibility of adopting. And I had my last myomectomy. I'd had four. I had the last one a year before the due date of my daughter, Ella. And a couple of months after the surgery, I went to go see my doctor who performed this, Dr. Petroza in Boston. And I said to him, I think that I'm pregnant. And he said, oh, Denise, the chances of that are very, very slim. And they took a test, a blood test, and it came back negative. And then some weeks later, I said, you know, I did one of those at-home tests, and it came back. I really think I am. So he said, you better come in. And so I came in, and they saw the yolk sac. And he said, oh, my God, this is amazing. But at the same time, he was very cautious. And he said, look, the probability of your being able to carry this child is very slim because the uterine muscle will not be able to hold, you know, the child. And so they said, this is a miracle that has happened, and we should give thanks and be grateful that this much has happened, but that you shouldn't get excited. And so from week to week, I was just praying, praying, oh, please, God, you know, let this child come forth. And she is so strong, Diane. She kicked and raised hallelujah like you can't believe the entire 9 months. And she came out a beautiful girl who has the strongest temperament and just as strong and full of life as you can imagine. And I was in Boston 2 weeks ago for an event, and I went to go see the doctor. I said, here she is. He said, Denise, this is an absolute miracle that this child came forth. And my heart explodes in enthusiasm and joy and in gratitude, because also there was an age factor. You know, I consider myself quite a young chickadee, but after, and I had been lying about my age until they printed the truth in the Washington Post. So everybody knows now that I'm 40 anyway. I called the writer after that. I said, I can't believe it. I said, everybody thinks I'm Phil 32. You know, how could you do that? Anyway.
You know, I think you become even more powerful when you frankly talk about your age. I am 68. And
brava.
Believe me, I do think that we become stronger as we identify ourselves as women of the age we are.
That's right. That's right. I agree with you. I agree.
So Ella is named for?
Ella Fitzgerald.
Of course.
Ella Fitzgerald.
Of course.
She has so many names, and they would all never fit on a driver's license, but she is Ella Thais Ann Yelena. So there you have it. And she is the joy and the greatest gift imaginable.
Does she travel with you?
So far, she's been traveling everywhere with me. And she's done really fine on the transatlantic flight. She's done okay. What's been problematic have been the delays. One of the first trips that we made was during Hurricane Charlie or something. And so we were trapped in Newark Airport for 12 hours. That was very, very trying.
Very difficult. You performed at the National Cathedral at the September 11 memorial service. I know you recorded this for a Red Cross album, a benefit album featuring not only yourself but others. This is such a special, extraordinary moment. that people around the world heard, and I'm so thankful you recorded it.
Waterfall for spacious skies, for amber waves of grain, for purple mountain majesties, above a fruited plain, America, America, God shed his grace on thee.
Tell us what you were thinking about that day, Denise.
Well, first of all, this is my first time hearing that that recording we did, which is not the actual recording from the memorial service itself, but a recording that we did in response to the outpouring response that we received afterward. You know, being an opera singer challenges us to develop a very intimate relationship with the text. And I think part of the job is staying out of the way. For sure, I believe that I'm just an instrument. I believe that I'm just a vessel through which this beautiful form passes. And the challenge is to remove myself. It is passing through the lens of my experience. It is passing through my heart and through my feelings as well. But the challenge is to let the music speak. And that's what I was trying to do, particularly on that day. And I was proud. I was really, really proud. I know it sounds corny, but I spend so much time out of this country, and I really, really understand. I think you're not really an American until you go to another country and you see how they, you know. I remember when I went as a 15-year-old, when I went to as an exchange student to Germany, and I remember hearing my host mother speak on the telephone, and she said, "We have an American staying with us." And I thought, my God, I'm an American. You know, and the proud pride that I felt in that.
Denise, talk a bit about your own background, how, because you were born and raised here in Washington, you went to the Duke Ellington School. When did your mother first begin to understand what a talented child you were?
She's listening now. Hi, Mom.
Oh,
she's
so
sitting
glad
with the baby at the moment.
Oh.
You know, I was giving an interview the other day, and I said, "Mom, when did I first start singing?" And she said, "I think you're 4 or 5. And I come from a family and a lineage of music makers. And my family had a singing group, my mother, my brother, my sister, myself. We were called the Inspirational Children of God, and we used to go around to different churches and perform. And my brother, who has a very, very beautiful voice, and my sister as well, and both of them could have made important careers had they the ambition or the desire to do so. My brother has a beautiful voice. My brother normally sang the solos in our little group. And I was really the kid who was clinging onto my mom's skirt. I was the one always hiding behind her. I was the one very socially awkward, very, you know, uncomfortable. I felt much more at ease when I was alone with myself, reading books or poetry or watching movies or that sort of thing. And one day, and my mother, in her great wisdom, and to try and her great effort to get to sort of rid me of my shyness, said to me once as we were standing there performing, and my brother usually sang the solo, she said, "Denise, you're going to sing the solo today." And she said this in front of everybody, you know, in the church. And I don't know if you've ever been to, you know, like an African-American church.
I
and this
have.
Was one of those, you know, holy rollers,
yeah.
lay on of hands, speaking
yeah.
in tongues, singing and shouting and getting merry like Christmas type of places. And there was no getting out of that. You know, once she sort of announced that, they
she
said, come
it,
on, come
it.
On and sing. And so that was my first experience. And that was my first audience. It was there in the church. And that's how it all began. And from there, I got involved in the choruses in school here in Washington, D.C. at W.B. Patterson with a marvelous woman named Judith Grove, who was my music teacher from kindergarten through sixth grade. When I left elementary school to go to junior high school, which was Friendship Junior High School, she also became the music teacher at that school, just by chance. And we ran into each other one day. She got me involved in All City Chorus, and she used to come pick me up on Saturdays for the rehearsal and bring me back. And I loved this woman. I still do love her and admire her greatly. Anyway, one day when I was in junior high school, I ran into her in the hallway, and she said, "Denise, there's a school called the Duke Ellington School in Georgetown, and it's a performing arts high school, and you have a lovely voice, and you should audition there for the music department." And I said, "Well, I don't know." And she said, "Well, let's get the application and fill it out together."
What
we
can
did.
It hurt?
What can
sure.
it hurt? Exactly. We filled it out. I did the audition. I was accepted, and she became the principal of the school.
Oh, my.
So from kindergarten through
all
the time that she
through.
Was really, really my guardian angel.
At 7 minutes before the hour. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. What about that first professional opening?
I had terrible stage fright, and I still am very, I get very, very nervous before performances. I get butterflies, all of that.
What do you do for that?
You know, I feel more comfortable now once I'm on the stage.
I see.
Before, you don't want to be around
yeah.
me. You could film The Exorcist 3. It's just, it's crazy. You know, I get very, very, very nervous, and I prefer to be alone, you know, before the performances. But in the beginning, I was paralyzed. I mean, I was frozen with fear. Really, they'd have to push me out on the, my very best girlfriend, Anna Serrano, who is a singer herself, soprano. We did an engagement together, singing just the Barcarolle from Hoffmann, you know, la da da la da 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 da, and I remember hearing somebody say, "Slap her," because I was frozen, and they kept calling, "Denise Graves to the stage, Denise Graves to the stage," and I couldn't move. My feet were nailed into the earth, and finally they said, and my girlfriend said, "Denise, how do you expect to have a career? Like, I mean, you know, you really have got to deal with this. You've got to address this." And slowly, slowly, slowly. And she would work with me. Hmm. My best girlfriend would, she would stage my arias that I would plan to do for my audition. We'd go into her bedroom and she said, "Okay, sing it." And she said, "Move your hand like this. And put your hand on your hip like this and do this with your eye." And she staged, really, measure by measure, each one of my arias. And she was a soprano.
But the first opening.
The very first opening, I would say, I would even say that it was when I was a student at Oberlin College for the sesquicentennial of Oberlin College, this piece by Conrad Cummings called Eros and Psyche.
Where my son went.
Is that right?
Piano major.
Fantastic school.
Fantastic
school. And I would, while I was still a student, for me it was my first opera, so it was professional to me. It certainly felt like that in every way. But you know, it happens very quickly. It's like everything. You spend years and years and years in the studio with your teachers and your coaches and work and directors working. And then, you know, your aria is over in 3 minutes and that's it. It's like, I feel like one of those ice skaters, you know, who did the triple toe, you know, loops
axel
or whatever.
Axel or whatever. Yeah.
You've got one chance out there. That's it. You know? And it goes by really, really quickly. And that's why you practice, so that your muscles memorize what has to be done. There is such a thing as muscle memory. And that's what practicing is all about, because more often than not, you know, I had a teacher who would say, Denise, you will not be judged on your best singing. You will be judged on your average singing. And you have to work to get your average singing above everybody else's. That's the challenge. Because the day that you're in the best voice, Diane, is the day you're vacuuming around your house and you're cleaning out the closets.
Denise Graves, I'd love to talk with you for another 3 hours. Our time is up.
What a shame.
Mezzo-soprano Denise Graves, currently appearing in the Washington National Opera's production of Il Trovatore. I wish we could have heard more music. I wish we could go on and on. You're a lovely young woman.
As are you.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much, Diane.
Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Elizabeth Terry, Ann Adams, Nancy Robertson, and Jonathan Smith. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman has been on the phones. The program comes to you from American University in Washington. For schedule information and audio archives, visit our website at WAMU.org. You can order cassettes online at WAMU.org or at 202-885-1200. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.